to another episode of the Regenerative Health Podcast. Now, I am very, very excited to be bringing you this episode. It is with Dr. Michael Wyman, who I believe is one of the world's leading decentralized cardiologists. So, Michael, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's going to be a fun one.
Great. Maybe we start with your credentials and how you arrived at this part of medicine.
So I'm a board-certified cardiologist. I did all my invasive cardiology training at St. Louis University School of Medicine and ended up staying in the area. So I launched my own practice here about 5 years ago, where now I just focus on the prevention of heart attacks and strokes. You know, I took all my invasive skills and didn't care of really sick people in ICU and used those to kind of reverse engineer what you need to do so you don't end up in those situations.
Yeah, reverse engineering, I love it. And that is what I try and do when I'm thinking about optimizing people's health and trying to understand what is going wrong so we can understand how to prevent it from happening. So maybe let's start with some definitions because, you know, ischemic heart disease and heart disease is one of the biggest, well, it is the biggest killer in society. So can you please define for our listeners what are the exact meaning of atherosclerosis, coronary artery disease, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, ischemic heart disease, all these key, very important definitions.
So for the majority of those that you just listed, they're basically synonyms. But, you know, you have nearly 60,000 miles of blood vessels. 99% of your blood vessels are, you know, significantly smaller than a human hair. It's the microvascular system. And as cardiologists, we're mostly focusing on the large blood vessels that you can see when you're doing procedures. But it's really looking at what is damaging the arteries and causing it to get inflamed and then plaque to build up. And so when that plaque starts to develop and calcify, that's when it first usually starts to get picked up on some of these screening tests and you're now diagnosed as having atherosclerosis or coronary artery disease.
Yeah. And the question that I kind of get a lot and I think a concern of that people have is, one, what caused my plaque or what caused the deposition of calcium in the blood vessels? And maybe that's been picked up on something like a coronary artery calcium score, or maybe it's been seen directly, more directly in something like an angiogram. So can you talk through the listener about how you think about coronary artery plaque and why it's developing and how it's developing?
So it takes a few explanations, but it's, you know, mostly about the lining of the arteries. There's a layer called the endothelium, and it's one cell thick. If you took out all your endothelium, it'd be the surface area of 6 tennis courts. So it's one of your largest organs. And one of its main jobs is to release nitric oxide, which is a very short-lived gas. That gas causes the artery walls to relax, so that keeps your blood pressure normal. But that nitric oxide also keeps the blood flowing well, so things don't stick to the artery lining. But only in the past few years, it was a little bit more recognized that there's something that actually protects the endothelium. That's known as the endothelial glycocalyx. It's a protective gel coat for the endothelium. So if you think of taking a fish out of water and it's slimy, that's essentially what the glycocalyx is. And I know your audience is pretty well versed in the kind of the quantum world. Well, that glycocalyx is heavily structured in water. And so that's kind of like the beginning part is that if that structured water collapses, then the lipoproteins, the white blood cells, they start aggregating or sticking to the artery lining. And then that may kick off that cascade of where if you don't stop it, plaque will build up. But there's infinite insults for that glycocalyx, but the body can only respond with 3 responses. And this I might learn from one of my mentors, Dr. Mark Hewson, many years ago. Those 3 finite responses are oxidative stress, inflammation, and autoimmune dysregulation. So those are normal responses, but they get dysregulated the longer they go on. And it's like a fire. If you don't shut the fire off, then the plaques start really forming in the arteries pretty significantly.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. And let's really be clear about this, the physiology of the blood vessel and the lining of this blood vessel. Because say if we're taking a cross-section of an artery and we've got the lumen or the inside of the vessel where the blood is flowing, and then if we progressively go down the layers, then you, as you mentioned, the first thing that we'll get to is a layer of structured water or exclusion zone water. And then we've got this glycocalyx, which can be thought of, as you mentioned, is a slippery, like almost fish-like substance. And I did research in mucins and as they relate to the gastrointestinal tract. And the glycocalyx can be thought as just a bunch of mucus-like stalks that are sticking out of the endothelium and providing a very slippery surface. So, and below that, we've got the endothelial layer, which, as you mentioned, is only one cell thick. So the question is, and maybe, again, to define this for everyone, what is the difference between these larger blood vessels in the artery and the venous system compared to the smaller as we go down in size?
So, yeah, the arteries are pretty much similar, even getting down into the capillary side. But on the venous side, you know, there's no smooth muscle in it. And so they're much thinner, less rigid vessels. So the real key is that, like, you know, atherosclerosis is, you know, it's mostly a artery facing disorder. Now, there is possibility to develop plaque in the veins, just not nearly as common, probably due to, like, there's lower shear stress going across the glycocalyx in the venous side. But as you had already mentioned, you know, there's a layer of the glycocalyx, there's endothelium, underneath that's the intima, then the media, then the adventitia. So if you think of an artery as like in cross-section, you know, you're slicing a garden hose in half, you know, you're mostly looking at what's going on in the wall of the artery. Too often in conventional cardiology, they're just focusing on what's in the lumen, either by looking at your blood or doing an angiogram and saying, like, you don't got a lot of blockages, so you don't get a stent, or you get a lot of blockages, here's your stent. Well, the stent relieves the obstruction, but it doesn't fix why you developed those plaques in the first place. And then you're just playing a game of whack-a-mole. You're putting in short stents, and you haven't really treated the 60,000 miles.
Yeah, exactly. And the question, therefore, that would seem logical step to me is that before we can even get to damaging the lining of the blood vessels, and like you mentioned, damage to that endothelial lining and the glycocalyx seems to be the prerequisite for forming plaque. And I don't think it's debated in conventional or more decentralized cardiology circles that you actually need endothelial damage as any type of prerequisite for any blood contents, whether they're red blood cells or lipoproteins, to actually enter the subintimal space and actually form plaque.
So I think it's not, you know, a either or. I think it's just more of a case where the more lipoproteins you have, the more glycocalyx disruption and endothelial dysfunction you have, the conditions are more likely you will develop plaque. You know, it's kind of the quantum world. It's like, it's not a guarantee. It's just probability. But there are cases where, you know, lipoproteins can get into the intimal space and you still have a fully intact glycocalyx and endothelium. You know, there are different receptors in the glycocalyx, but it just tends to be more when the glycocalyx has been shed. And again, it's kind of like, think about like seagrass at the bottom of a water source. Is that if that seagrass gets shed, then there's different receptors that are kind of sticking out. And then, you know, more of these lipoproteins and white blood cells and platelets start aggregating and sticking to that endothelial surface and then are more likely to kind of get in. I really don't like the term, and you may not either, but like leaky gut. It's essentially like leaky arteries. There's more gaps, more places for the lipoproteins to get through.
Yeah. And I think the point that you made is particularly relevant. Maybe we're going to get to the difference between people with a actual pathological lipid physiology, which is people with mutations in various genes that with related things like familial hypercholesterolemia, compared to people with intact lipid physiology. And I guess the angle of the question was that to me it seems like if we have an intact structured water layer above our glycocalyx in someone with a normal lipid physiology, then it seems to me very difficult for any type of glycocalyx damage or clot or plaque formation to be initiated and therefore continue.
Yes, I mean, you know, the glycocalyx is, you know, continually being shed and continually being rebuilt. And it's one of those things where it's like the glycocalyx is heavily negatively charged because of all the sulfur units in it. And the lipoproteins, the red blood cells, they're all negatively charged as well. And negative repels negative. And so with my patients, I talk about like kind of being like a maglev train. You know, if your arteries have a very healthy layer of the glycocalyx, those lipoproteins should be repelled from it and slide on by. But there's something that's going to damage the glycocalyx. And then, you know, it's, you know, a positive and a negative. Things will attract.
Yeah, that's a fantastic analogy. I really like that. So say there is damage to this glycocalyx. Maybe explain what happens next, because clotting, I believe, is at the underlying this whole process of both acute plaque rupture, but also the chronic process of plaque formation.
So inside the glycocalyx, it's kind of like another way to think about it, like think about a marsh. There's different creatures that live inside this marsh. And then, you know, some of these things are helpful at knocking down oxidative stress. So there's superoxide dismutase. You know, you're continuously breathing oxygen to make energy in your cells. You know, that oxygen can be toxic to the arteries. So the superoxide dismutase knocks down some of the reactive oxygen species. And there's different clotting factors inside the glycocalyx. And so think of it as kind of like something where, like, if it gets scratched, you want to be able to clot as needed. But there are certain things that will tend to really kind of denude the glycocalyx, and then that sets it up where you're more likely to clot than you are to bleed. And so it's going from a normal physiologic process to a pathologic process when the glycocalyx is severely shed and you start becoming more hypercoagulable.
And what are some of the factors that are going to be contributing to this, again, to disturb this structured water and then start shearing or damaging this protective seagrass layer?
Yeah, the biophysical is, you know, pressure. So hypertension, you know, I often tell people it's not necessarily a disease, but it's a marker that you're not really having a healthy lining of your artery. Your arteries probably have very low levels of nitric oxide availability, and the arteries are very stiff. But the higher the shear stress, the more that's going to damage that glycocalyx layer. And then there's a whole host of biochemical things, but, you know, dysregulated insulin and glucose are high on the list. More likely the oxidized lipids are going to damage it. Infections, microplastics, heavy metals, toxins like air pollution. You know, there's numerous things that can damage the glycocalyx, and the body's always trying to repair. But it's when you kind of overwhelm that repair system that you tend to go into the points where the person starts developing endothelial dysfunction, vascular inflammation, soft plaque, hard plaque, and events. But you have many years to intervene before they have those events.
Yeah, and explain to us what the difference is between the soft plaque and the hard plaque. And as you said, this is an exercise in prevention. And just like there's steps along the way of detecting insulin resistance before someone becomes fully blown type 2 diabetic, there's steps along the way that we can identify the progression of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease before someone ends up in the emergency department with acute chest pain.
No, and that's a great kind of segue into it, is that, you know, in the United States, you know, every 40 seconds, somebody has a myocardial infarction. And often the first time that they have a symptom is having the heart attack. They had no warning sign this was going to happen. But it's been building up in them for many years, most likely. It sometimes starts in your teens and 20s, where you first develop, you know, glycocalyx disruption, endothelial dysfunction. Then you start developing vascular inflammation, where the intima starts to swell. So as more and more lipoproteins, you know, get retained in the intima, it starts to swell. Much like if you sprain your ankle, it's going to swell. Or if you get a splinter, it's going to swell a territory. As the white blood cells come and investigate, why are these lipoproteins getting retained in the intima? And then like a game of Pac-Man, the monocytes start gobbling it up. They became foam cells. And then this is the nidus to start developing these, quote, soft plaques. The soft plaques, the body's going to keep trying to take care of it. It's going to put smooth muscle down over it to kind of scar it over, and eventually it will ossify it or calcify it. So the body, if it calcifies it, that's probably going to be a stable scar, and it's probably not going to cause you any symptoms unless that scar builds up to a state where you have now a 70 or 80% blockage or stenosis in your artery, and the lumen is, you know, not, you know, flowing very well. So that is one of the cases where that's really late to the game. And sometimes that's the first time that people, you know, end up seeing a cardiologist, is that they start having chest pain with exercise or shortness of breath or exercise intolerance. And then they go get a stress test and it's abnormal. And they're like, oh, you have severe coronary disease. Yeah, we're going to do an angiogram. And they get a stent and they think they're all fixed. But that's just their introduction. You know, you haven't fixed their endothelial dysfunction, their vascular inflammation, or really talked to them about why their lipoproteins might be damaging their arteries. So that's kind of conventional. But there are a whole host of testing you can do that looks at the health of the lining of the arteries. And then you can look for the degree of soft plaque with carotid scans using ultrasound. You can use different CT scans to look at the soft or hard plaque in the coronary arteries. And you can really tell people, hey, you have advanced disease, even though you've not had any symptoms. And then those are the people that want to be more aggressive with pharmaceutical agents, supplements, and lifestyle interventions.
Yeah, and I want to be really clear about the exact pathophysiology of what's happening when someone is having maybe chronic vessel damage that's leading to plaque formation and versus that acute event that leads to occlusion or obstruction of an artery that leads again to symptoms. So explain the difference to us.
So in the first case, you know, that's going to be more stable angina where this plaque has been building up over time. The body is forming smooth muscle over this plaque. And then it calcifies it. You know, the lumen is where the blood is flowing. So again, if you think of a garden hose and you slice it in half, you know, until the lumen is occluded 70%, most people are not going to have any symptoms. You're getting enough oxygen nutrients downstream where the tissues can continue to make, you know, energy from the blood. But once you start going above 70-80%, most of the time when it's under physiological stress, either from mental stress or exercise, the person starts having symptoms. They may feel a pressure, tightness, squeezing in their chest, their short of breath, or the exercise that they used to be able to do, they just can't do it. They stop the activity, the heart rate slows down, the cardiac output goes down, and then the symptoms improve. But every time they do that type of activity or get their heart rate back up, they typically keep having those symptoms. Now, where it's more concerning is when the person has no symptoms. They may have only a 30% plaque or blockage in one of their arteries. They cannot feel that plaque. And these plaques can become unstable, often in this situation where there's a lot of inflammation and oxidative stress. Think of these caps as, or these plaques as like pimples on the wall of the artery. If it's a really thin pimple and it's inflamed, then that pimple could pop. And then all the oxidized, damaged cholesterol, white blood cells, and other cellular debris that's in this plaque, which is kind of like an abscess in the artery wall, it spills out into the bloodstream. And now the body basically thinks it's bleeding, and then all these coagulation cascades kick in and form a clot. You know, it's a big platelet plug. And it seals that plaque rupture, but it acts as a dam to all the tissues downstream, so no oxygen nutrients go downstream. So when these plaques rupture in your heart, that's what we would call a heart attack. If it's in your brain, it's a stroke. Now, there are other heart attacks where there's aortic, you know, dissections tearing down into arteries or the spontaneous coronary, you know, dissections. You know, there are some ulcerated plaques that occasionally rupture, but the majority of plaques, it's a, you're going along fine. And then when these plaques ruptures, the blood clots, you start having your event.
Yeah. And that's a really important point to make because the degree of disease or maybe occlusion that we might have detected on something like a CT coronary angiogram doesn't necessarily correlate to the probability of having an acute myocardial infarction. And that is what I'm presuming is because the occlusive event is a massive thrombus or blockage of the artery from red blood cell accumulation. And whether you have 30% stenosis or 70% stenosis, it is an individual process, but equally, depending on the underlying vascular inflammation, could those two situations lead to an AMI and an emergency presentation?
Correct. Yeah. And that was always kind of the scary thing is that, you know, there's people who come in and they had no symptoms and, you know, often they had, quote, normal cholesterol, you know, and people are like, well, they just had bad luck. It's probably genes. And yes, there probably is some genetic, you know, role for some of these people, but, you know, it's really something in their life disrupted their glycocalyx and endothelium for a long period of time. And this cascade happened. It does not generally happen overnight. And so that's why it's one of those cases where it's like, if you start looking earlier, you start finding those people that, hey, they have really low nitric oxide. Their arteries are stiff. They're starting to have higher blood pressure. You know, you check some biomarkers and they got high sensitivity CRP elevated. Okay, what's going on with this person? And start trying to find out well before they ever have their first symptom.
Yeah, and I think one case that really illustrates this well is Stephen Hussey, who I've interviewed, and I'm sure you're aware of. He's talking about the quantum and circadian implications of heart disease, and he had an acute myocardial infarction and basically occlusion of his left anterior descending artery. But when they looked at his, when they did the angiogram, he had no disease. He had no hard plaque. So that is indicating that the process of his heart attack was a spontaneous clot. And in the setting of those inflammatory factors that we talked about really briefly earlier.
Correct, yes. And it's one of the cases where, you know, you don't always have, you know, a severe stenosis when these people have heart attacks.
So the goal needs to be keeping that endothelium as stable and as least inflamed as possible, in my mind. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Again, it's, you know, it's the three finite responses. It's the oxidation, the inflammation, and the autoimmune dysregulation. If you can keep those at bay, you don't tend to keep going down those pathways where these plaques build.
And maybe one more concept to delineate before we go further is this idea of Virchow's triad, and as it relates to blood clotting and coronary artery disease and AMIs.
Sure. And actually, it had been a while since I actually thought about the actual triad, but it's, you know, it's injury, there's stasis, and then there's this hypercoagulable response. And it fits in the story of the glycocalyx, is that, you know, something damages the glycocalyx, that sets off the case where these hypercoagulable factors get released and the blood's more likely to clot. But you know, what we call stasis, well, I mean, that would be, you know, in the kind of quantum world, you know, it's, you know, low redox potential. You don't have enough net negative charge to have the blood flow, you know, on its own, essentially, over the negatively charged glycocalyx. You know, so that's where I would start thinking about, is like stasis is a lack of electrons.
Yeah, and you can imagine that a lack of electrons from a lack of grounding and a lack of negative charge that is repelling those red blood cells away from each other and away from the lipoproteins and away from the glycocalyx could potentially cause stasis. And the other two, I mean, hypercoagulability in a state of insulin resistance vessel injury from whether that's, you know, just a decade of smoking and those particulates are cleaving and shaving off your glycocalyx. Maybe it's actually a good opportunity to talk about briefly the perspective of cardiac physiology that relates to the microcirculation and the fact that maybe the heart is was not the only source of propulsion on flow in blood vessels. What's your perspective on this idea, is the heart is not a pump?
So, Matt, I've read Dr. Cohen's book, and I know some of Dr. Hussey's postings are, you know, talking about this. It's an interesting theory. I think it's plausible. It makes sense to me. But is it something that I give a lot of credence to? No, I don't really think too much about it because, you know, either it is or it isn't. But it's the same things I'm going to teach people. It's like I want them outside grounding. I want them getting full spectrum sun on their body. I want them to avoid fluoride in their water. So all the things that are going to improve their net negative charge is going to improve, you know, the flow through this, 60,000 miles of blood vessels that you have. But, you know, it is interesting that, you know, the heart, you know, is one of the most energy dense organs. But even that being true, it may not have enough, force to be able to truly pump blood through that kind of a distance. And I know that there's, you know, been some studies where, you know, they've, you know, just shined infrared light on, you know, blood vessels and the flow continues to go. So, you know, that's an interesting, experiment. And yeah, I think it's plausible, but I don't spend too much time worrying about it.
Yeah. And you're right. If the implications of it are the same, then yeah, the practicalities is what matters. And I think you're referring to the Dr. Gerald Pollack's recent paper on the driving of blood beyond the heart, I think. And he showed in a chick embryo, the shining of infrared light was able to potentiate blood flow. So yeah, it's a very interesting area of development. So talk to us now, Michael, about what are some of these indicators that we might look into for gauging our endothelial health. If we've accepted what you and I have said for the first 20 minutes of this interview, that inflammation in our blood vessels is important, endothelial dysfunction is important, and the health of those blood vessels are important. So how can we get an insight into their health?
So with my patients, I always talk about that there's two things we need to look at. We need to look at the biophysical and we need to look at the biochemical, because if you just look at one or the other, you don't really have the full picture. So I usually start with, what is actually going on with the arteries? Because that is really going to tell you how aggressive to be with the things that you see floating through your blood. So the endothelium, there's a few things you can use to test it. At home, it can just be as simple as, is your blood pressure less than 120 over 80? Good. That's a good start. If you're a man, do you have erectile dysfunction? If you do, you're probably going to have some microvascular disease. Now you got to figure out, okay, why do you have microvascular disease? In the office, there are tests you can do where you can test your salivary nitric oxide levels. It's like a little salivary sample on this, a litmus paper type. And the brighter red it is, the more you can make nitric oxide through that salivary pathway. There's devices that look at pulse wave velocity. So essentially, how elastic are your arteries? If your arteries are really elastic, like an accordion, they're probably making good nitric oxide. If your arteries are like a lead pipe, they're probably pretty sick. There are tests that look at your ability to release nitric oxide on a vascular stressor has been applied. And this would be called the EndoPET test. It's a 15-minute non-invasive test where you have a blood pressure cuff pumped up on your arm higher than your systolic blood pressure, and you have probes on each of your fingers measuring the flow. And then after a 5-minute occlusive period, you open up the blood pressure cuff, the blood rushes back down into your hand, and that blood's going to flow over the glycocalyx. That is transduced to the underlying endothelium, like, hey, here comes a big slug of blood. And then nitric oxide gets released, the smooth muscle in the artery relaxes, and the flow rushes back down to your hand, and your hand wakes up. And then with this system, we can calculate, how much do your arteries dilate when there's this vascular stressor? And optimal, your arteries should triple or quadruple in size. But if your arteries, the cutoff is 1.68. So if your arteries don't dilate more than 168%, then you have endothelial dysfunction. And you got to go looking in through the biomarkers or their lifestyle. Okay, what's driving that? So that's how you kind of test the endothelium. And then on the biochemistry part of it, you would look at labs such as homocysteine, uric acid, ADMA, which stands for asymmetric dimethylarginine. And then there's just that old school urine microalbumin creatinine ratio. So if you're leaking protein into your urine, that means you've damaged the glycocalyx to the arteries in your kidney and you're leaking protein. So those are kind of the starting points to tell a person, how healthy their arteries are. And then we can get into talking about, once that has been broken down, what can you expect with soft plaque, hard plaque, and what tests you should look for that then?
Thanks for that, Michael. Yeah, and it's a good place to mention that nitric oxide, this highly labile gas that you mentioned, has an incredibly important role in vasodilation or opening up those blood vessels. And it is essentially stimulated or released, liberated, when we get ultraviolet A light on our skin. I think that's the key distinction. And previous listeners of my podcast would have heard the episode with Professor Richard Weller, who was instrumental in discovering that pathway and therefore kind of joining dots to show that people with higher UV light exposure have less cardiovascular death, less cardiovascular mortality, less cardiovascular disease. So, and with regard to those assessments of endothelial dysfunction or health, do you typically see, I'm guessing you see people with type 2 diabetes who smoke regularly, who have never grounded before, they have poorer endothelial health on those metrics?
They would, but I would say I probably have a more health conscious minded practice at this point. So I think I count on my hand of my, had nearly 900 patients. I think less than 5 of them still actively smoke. How many are actually truly type 2 diabetics? Probably less than 5 as well. I mean, there's a lot of pre-diabetics and people with early signs of insulin resistance, but people who are frank diabetic with A1Cs near 10, like I used to see all the time, very, very few. But those are the people that, yes, you're basically probably going to be more secondary prevention for those people. This isn't their first rodeo. Now, if you're smoking, that is like the number one thing that's going to damage the glycocalyx. Now, it's not the nicotine. It's all the heavy metals and other toxins in the combustible cigarette. It's the delivery form that's the problem. That then shears off your glycocalyx, and now everything else is going to be starting to stick there. Oh, and you got an A1C of 10? Okay, well, great. You're never going to regrow that glycocalyx, and you're just going to have all this microvascular disease. And that's what you see at these patients, you know, go blind. They lose, you know, their extremities. You know, they have kidney failure. You know, yes, they also tend to develop some macrovascular disease where they're getting stents, but it's the microvascular system and those people that you really see kind of go downhill quickly.
Well, it sounds like you've selected for a very health conscious patient population. But I love the analogy of the seagrass and the grass, because it actually reminds me of regenerative farming, which is one part of the optimal health puzzle that I like to talk about with regard to food sourcing. But I'm just imagining grass, and if you're constantly mowing it, or you're constantly whippersnipping it with a brush cutter, and then you're not letting it grow back, then that, and maybe you're spraying herbicides on it. That's maybe an analogy for what's happening to the endothelial glycocalyx when we're inhaling diesel particulate fumes and, you know, drinking Mountain Dew every day. And that glycocalyx is just getting hammered by the fluctuating blood glucose and all those micro particulate particles.
I think that's a, you know, perfect analogy. I often use that one about seagrass, is that, you know, because the glycocalyx has these like little strands out there, and it's sensing the flowing blood, and it's sending information to the underlying endothelium. And, you know, there are certain things that will damage, you know, one patient's glycocalyx that won't necessarily damage others, but it's sometimes thousands of micro cuts is what's doing it. And you have to go figure out like, hey, what are the major drivers for this person? But fortunately, there's a lot of things you can do, even if you don't get to the absolute root cause. You know, we've talked about some of them. It's just like, you know, proper sun exposure, grounding, you know, proper hydration that doesn't have fluoride in it. Like, you're just trying to allow the body to have as many kind of building blocks as it needs to start regenerating the glycocalyx, because the body is pretty resilient if you get out of its way. But, you know, I was reading on a podcast and they were asking about the microplastic situation. You know, there's a recent study that was talking about that about half the patients that were getting carotid endarterectomy surgeries, they were finding these microplastics inside the plaque. And it's presumed that they're probably ingesting them, but they could also be inhaling them. But the more interesting thing wasn't that like there was these microplastics in the plaque. In my mind, it's why didn't all of them have it in their plaque? What was reducing the risk of some of those people not getting it? My suspicion is that those people had, you know, bad glycocalyxes briefly, but they were doing some more things that prevented the microplastics from getting retained in there. So, you know, that's how I kind of think about it. It's like, you know, what can you do to improve the lining of the glycocalyx? Well, you know, there are some, you know, patented nutraceuticals that kind of give the building blocks to the glycocalyx, but a lot of it is just trying to remove the insults, because we're all going to be exposed to things. It's just, you know, everybody has a different threshold for when those insults are going to really lead to the diseases.
Yeah, great point. And that specific trial study was very interesting. And I'll just reiterate that it showed when they took essentially reamed out the inside of these carotid arteries in people, and they analyzed the plaque that they removed and found microplastics. And yeah, you're right. That is the right question, which is why did some people have this and others didn't? And Dr. Jack Cruz made the point that, I mean, melanin, if we've cultivated our melanin and our, from a quantum point of view, our melanin is acting like it's a heavy metal complex or an other form of antioxidant, then that's one particular reason why we could help to detoxify or remove those type of substances. And the question I wanted to ask you was specifically about homocysteine. So you mentioned it. What degree is a raised homocysteine a risk factor in the context of perhaps no other you know, deranged blood markers, and how is it having its effect on raising the risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease?
So homocysteine is an amino acid that's supposed to get converted to methionine. I usually like to see a level of homocysteine less than 8. You know, and often if it's elevated, the person may have, you know, chronic kidney disease, you know, that might be driving it. It's just the detoxification pathways don't work well in the people with renal failure. But often it's a person who has a MTHFR mutation, either, you know, homozygous or heterozygous 677 or 1298 mutation. And you need to be able to methylate the homocysteine to methionine. If you build up high levels of homocysteine, it will often drive up the asymmetric dimethylarginine. And asymmetric dimethylarginine competes with endothelial nitric oxide synthase to produce nitric oxide. So the higher your ADMA levels, the lower your nitric oxide. So in patients who have high homocysteine, and then you discover that they have a methylation issue, then often you will support them with different methylated products, drive the homocysteine back down, you see the ADMA go down, often they start making more nitric oxide. And it's all about, you know, keeping nitric oxide high and available.
Interesting, because the other things that can drive up homocysteine are like a B12, obviously a vitamin B12 deficiency, riboflavin, and a folate deficiency as well. So it's tied in to cardiovascular risk via nitric oxide.
Correct. And yes, that's, you know, usually I'm saying, like, when people have a methylation issue, they're often going to have either low B12 or folate, or likely both in some instances. And then you give them a combination replacement to get their levels of B12 and folate back to optimal. Those are cofactors. And there's a few other things like bioptrin that then help this methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme convert the homocysteine back into methionine.
Okay, yeah, that's a little bit of a technical but interesting point. Thank you. So we've done these, and maybe one more that you could describe for us is the high sensitivity CRP. And C-reactive protein is obviously cleaved as produced by the liver and is an indicator of inflammation. But how do you look at high sensitivity CRP as a cardiovascular risk indicator?
It's included in my, you know, panel that I check for all new and established patients. You know, it is a, you know, quick check on the inflammation system. You know, you want, you know, I tell patients, you know, it depends on if you're coming in and this is pure on screening, your hsCRP should be normal. But if you recently had an infection, surgery, musculoskeletal injury, you should expect it to be slightly high. It's not a problem if it's high and you have a ready explanation. The problem is when it's, you know, 2, 3, 4 for years and you don't know why they have this high sensitivity CRP elevated. So then you got to start doing the, you know, detective work. You know, often it's untreated sleep apnea, it's insulin resistance, it's some type of, you know, sensitivity to gluten possibly. You know, there's something that's going to be driving it. And then you try to withdraw that and the CRP goes down. But it's not the be-all, end-all test. But it's one of those cases where, like, if you have high sensitivity CRP high and lipoproteins, you're much more worried about that person. And then this is the kind of idea of why, you know, statins have this potential pleiotropic effect at lowering inflammation. That may be one of the reasons why they actually work, not just lowering the lipoproteins.
Yeah. Okay. So we've looked at these specific biomarkers, and then we really get to the lipid panel. And there is so much controversy over, and I think a lot of ambiguity as to what we're actually, what people are talking about when they're referring to cholesterol and these other blood lipids. So maybe give us a quick overview of what are the main lipid components in a lipid panel. What do you look at, and to what degree are they helping us predict this disease?
So in a traditional lipid panel, there's four things that, you know, mostly get reported. You know, there's total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, triglycerides, and LDL cholesterol, which sometimes is just calculated. You really want to have at least a direct LDL-C, but I'll get to that in a moment. Like, that's probably still not enough. So in a traditional panel, you know, if the total cholesterol is over 300 milligrams per deciliter and the LDL cholesterol is over 190 milligrams per deciliter, then the person may have familial hyperlipidemia, which is a genetic abnormality, often with the LDL receptors, where the person just doesn't clear lipoproteins very effectively from the bloodstream, and then they have these higher levels of total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol. So I will always look at that in every patient. But there are some patients who, you know, had, quote, normal panels. They do one of these kind of more restrictive diets where, you know, they're full keto or carnivore with high saturated fat, and they may see this panel happen, even though that they don't have FH. But I don't put a lot of stock in the traditional panel to predict risk because, again, half the people coming into the hospital who have heart attacks have, quote, normal cholesterol. In a traditional panel, yeah, I will look at the triglycerides because it's often a sign, is the person insulin resistant or not? Now, I generally like to see the triglycerides less than 80, but you'll see some people who are very, fit, no evidence of insulin resistance, and they have high triglycerides. Well, there's certain genes that affect lipoprotein lipase at times that raise the triglycerides. So it's not a perfect metric, but in many people, it's a marker of insulin resistance if it's high. And then the HDL cholesterol, it's anybody's guess at this time. There's just actually a recent trial that came out where they were infusing HDL in patients having ST elevation MIs, and it showed no benefit for these patients. So the HDL side of the equation is still very, very murky. I really dislike the term good cholesterol. You should almost basically not look at your HDL cholesterol. Focus more on the LDL side of the equation first, especially if you have plaque in your arteries. So that's how I do when I look at the traditional panel. But if anything, patients are going to see me for, they're going to be doing some of the advanced, lipoprotein analysis. So we're doing the NMR analysis and then checking an ApoB. And then that's really where you can get into helping people understand what their risk is.
Yeah, and maybe we won't specifically go into the nuances of lipidology this conversation, because I really do want to get the rest of your thoughts on a range of other topics, and maybe we can come back to it. But say you've assessed someone's risk based on some blood work. Maybe now explain to us what you're going to do next. And I think before we even go there, you can explain those three concepts of primordial prevention, primary prevention, and secondary prevention.
So start there. So secondary prevention, you've already had a heart attack, you've already had a stroke, you have stents in your arteries, you've had bypass surgery. We're trying to prevent you from having it again. And yes, I do have some patients that have had prior events. Often, they're not under my care. They've had them out in the real world, and they come to see me to try to not have it again. Little ambiguity at that point. That's honestly where most cardiologists play. They're only treating people who've had events. And so that's why they're not going to talk about a lot of things that I'm talking about, because one, they've never learned about it. And two, these aren't the patients that they're seeing. They're seeing the sickest of the sick. And so they're throwing the kitchen sink at these people. But primary prevention in the classic world is that you've not prior had an event. But if you're only using conventional tools, you're going to miss things. And so if you use a lot of these advanced testing, they're probably not necessarily primary prevention. They're probably 1.5. They're not one, they're not two. But primordial means you're born, you have perfectly healthy arteries. How do you stay that way? That is really, really challenging. There are certain tests that I do, a CT angiogram test, which uses AI to look at the arteries and looks for plaque. I've screened, a couple hundred patients over the past 3 years. I've only seen two women with perfect scores. I've never seen a man not have some degree of salt plaque in their arteries. Now I'm starting to start screening people less than 40. That is a caveat, is that most I'm screening patients over 40. But last year saw a 36-year-old gentleman who had a calcium score nearly 1400. CT angio had severe right coronary stenosis, and he got stented before he came to see me. And then we're doing deep dive. Okay, how did you end up with such severe disease at 36 years old? So I think primordial prevention is the goal, and we really need to kind of keep teaching the primary care doctors and even the pediatricians what to be looking for, because this is a disease that starts in your teens, 20s, and a lot of your habits, they're set and, not stone, but a lot of your nutritional habits are set when you're a teenager, and your exercise, patterns are set as a teenager. Those are two big levers that people need to kind of optimize as they move forward.
Great. And I want to make the point of how relevant this is in terms of lifestyle, and how our lifestyle in this modern age right now, I believe, is increasingly responsible for the development of atherosclerotic disease at younger and younger ages. And I believe there was an observational study done of a Catawban population who are living a traditional lifestyle in their island location. They're eating mainly coconut oil as a kind of a fat source. They're eating fresh fish. They're obviously grounded. They're getting a heap of sun. And I think they even smoke. They have a high rate of smoking, and the amount of coronary disease that they have is very, very little. Whereas you're talking about now the fact that if everyone is doing everything wrong with regard to these risk factors that we've briefly talked about, then we're gonna see a deposition of plaque earlier and earlier and younger and younger.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, you know, 80-90% of this really could be prevented with, you know, the things that, you know, you and your audience frequently would talk about. You know, it's setting your circadian rhythms, it's grounding, it's, you know, avoiding, you know, toxins when you can. You know, it's improving your net negative charge. You know, those things make you more resilient for the infinite insults you're going to see as you go forward. But I think it's the, you know, story of that our technology is great to be able to talk across the world with each other, but too many people get drawn inside in front of these things all day long, and they never touch the ground outside. They never see a sunrise. They never spend more than 3 minutes outside in any one day. They eat highly ultra processed food. And, you know, it's, you know, I sometimes get pigeonholed and think that, like, you know, people ask me, like, well, you don't have, you know, a diet to recommend every cardiac patient. I'm like, it's individualized, you know, like, you know, I want to know, like, your maternal haplotype. Where do you live in the world? You know, what are your goals? Like, are you trying to lose weight, add weight, you know, add muscle? Like, there's going to be some nuance to it. But food is important. But, you know, as Dr. Cruz talks about, you know, it's maybe 5, 6, 7 down on the list. You know, you got to get your light environment right first. And most people, unless they're working with me, they haven't even started to even think about that as the big thing that they have been missing in their life. You know, why are they showing up sicker than they should be? Nope, they have not really slept well, and the circadian rhythms are way off.
How do you think about the sunlight and the circadian rhythm as it particularly pertains to the development of atherosclerosis?
I mean, the body has, you know, different circadian timings in the heart. You know, at nighttime, you know, your blood pressure is dropping. It should drop by at least 15% while you sleep, and it starts to increase in the morning, you know, as cortisol starts to rise. This is why a lot of times heart attacks happen between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. as cortisol is rising, your blood's getting stickier, your blood pressure is going up. And then there are reasons why that, you know, if you don't have your circadian rhythms dialed in, you're going to be more insulin resistant. So it is all, you know, connected. But, you know, I think you had said it earlier, you know, it's like teaching the person how to use the sun appropriately. You know, I'm not telling people to go outside 24/7 and bake. It's getting morning light in your eyes, set your circadian rhythms. Ideally, expose more skin so that your skin is preconditioned for when UVA and UVB come out later in the day. But the more infrared A you can soak up, the more nitric oxide is going to get liberated from your skin and keep your blood pressure normal, keep your blood flowing like red wine, not so much like ketchup. So it's just teaching people the simple ways to kind of rewild themselves, just get back into nature.
Yeah, I love that. So let's talk about screening and maybe risk stratification, because what type of imaging would you suggest for people at different stages of this heart disease prevention journey?
And that's a good point, is that I do recommend imaging. I mean, there's a lot of different risk calculators people can use, and they're good at a population level, but you really want to know, do you have plaque? You know, what do you need to do? So you need to go look at the arteries. So head to toe, you know, there's different scans you can do. You know, if you've had other scans for other reasons, you can always look at the results and see if they ever mentioned that you have any calcified plaques in the brain or your abdomen. Or, you know, I've seen some ones where people get panoramas of their teeth and they see some plaque in their carotid artery that's calcified. So look at your old imaging if you have access to it. But if you don't have those, you know, often I will start with patients getting a carotid intimal medial thickness ultrasound. No radiation, takes about 5 minutes. The scan of the arteries on the side of the neck. It's something that you can repeat, you know, generally yearly. You have a baseline and see what has changed. If you're doing things right, things shouldn't change year over year. Ideally, you see things getting better if they already had intimal thickening and you've got it improving. You know, it was Dr. Thomas Sydenham in the 1600s, the famous saying, a man is as old as his arteries. So if your vascular age is higher than your biological age, you got a problem. That being said, you know, there are other tests. You know, you really want to look at your coronary arteries non-invasively. You know, for somebody who's, you know, probably around the age of 40, and this is kind of in the primordial primary prevention, you know, a CT coronary calcium scan is a good starting point. often joke it's kind of like a mammogram for the heart. You know, it's going to put you, you know, in buckets. You know, are you truly low risk and you have a calcium score of 0, or do you have a calcium score over 400 and you're high risk? Now, it's common people will develop a positive calcium score sometime in their life, but I've seen people in their 80s and their scores have still been 0. But I've seen a 36-year-old with a score nearly 1400. So just looking at somebody from the outside, you have no idea what the coronary arteries are going to look like unless you do one of these type of tests. But the downside of the calcium score test is that it will not see any of the soft plaque. So if the person has a strong family history of early cardiovascular disease, or they have, quote, scary blood work, well, then maybe you would add on a CT coronary angiogram. You know, it's a little bit more radiation. There's a contrast, you know, risk. You know, so you have to have an IV, have normal kidney function, and there's a cost risk. You know, it's probably a factor of 10 to 15 times more expensive to do a CT angiogram than it is a calcium score test. But it's a more sensitive test and will tell you, you know, with a high degree of certainty, you know, how much stenosis you have in your arteries, but it's more going to tell you about the soft versus hard plaque in your arteries. And so that's a good starting point for most people. It's like, do something that looks at your carotid arteries, do something that looks at your coronary arteries.
Yeah, and I've talked to radiologists about this problem. And in the emerging field, which is something that I'm trying to cultivate of decentralized radiology, there's a lamentation that all this imaging is being done for CT chests, for abdominal MRI, abdominal CT, and the biggest findings that are relevant to the patient's long-term cardiovascular metabolic health aren't even being reported on, and that is the presence of calcified hard plaque in these arteries. That there's an incidental finding that the radiologist might have made a note of it in their head, but they don't put it on the report. And if they don't put it on the report, then no one does anything about it. And people can go for 10 years, 15 years, and then they wind up in, you know, the emergency department, and you know, I see them in the emergency room with chest pain, and maybe this could have been prevented if the radiologist had made a comment on it, you know, 15 years ago.
No, that's a very good point. And that's something I've been doing for many years, is just looking at any old imaging and finding stuff. And like, did you know that they reported your coronary arteries are calcified 10 years ago? I'm like, nobody ever told me that. I'm like, well, you know, that's not surprising. It's unfortunate. But yeah, you know, I was recently at a conference where they were talking about how they're using AI to basically tackle this one problem, is that they're going to take old images and they're going to feed it through the machine and look for these, you know, cardiac calcifications and images that weren't designed to look for it. So they had to, they're not going to be as precise because they're not gated images, but it's better than nothing. And it's already basically free data. It's already been done. So if you can give some information to the patient that is something that they did 5 years ago, you might kind of be able to help intervene well before they're having symptoms still.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something I've been in discussion with a cardiac radiologist about. So if any radiologists are listening and want to actually start reporting the important metabolic findings, then get in touch with me. But the next question that I have for you, Michael, is when, so you mentioned that the calcium score is a great start and it's cheap in Australia. I believe it costs about $150 dollars from any kind of radiology practice. You just get a request from your GP. And if you want to do a CT coronary angio, that's a bit more involved. But what would be the indications for you to step beyond those tests? But even what are the implications of some of the findings of the calcium and the CT coronary angio?
So starting with, you know, what would you normally see is that, you know, most general cardiologists are not going to do these type of testing. You know, they're only going to do these testing once you have symptoms, and they're going to recommend some type of stress test. And stress tests are useful if you're having symptoms. They're going to try to recreate your symptoms in this environment where, you know, they're exercising you and see like, oh, when you have chest pain, it happens when you get to this heart rate. And then you have a wall motion abnormality on echo or perfusion defect on nuclear imaging. But again, it's kind of a late to the game type of finding. So often, you know, the images that you find on a calcium score or CT angio, you know, you're just helping risk stratify that person into buckets, you know, like on the CT angiogram, you know, there's a company in the States called Clearly that uses AI and machine learning to quantify the quality of the plaque. They have a scoring algorithm that's 0, 1, two or three. And it's kind of like cancer screening, you know, are you kind of like local cancer or is it metastatic? So the more plaque you have, the higher cardiovascular events occur. And so those are the people that need much more intensive, you know, pharmaceutical supplement and lifestyle interventions. And so you're often using these tests mainly to risk stratify people, like how aggressively am I actually going to treat this person?
Because that's such an important point, because I have seen calcium scores done and patients get referred to a cardiologist, and that is a indication or, dare I say the word excuse, for invasive angiography, stenting, and bypass surgery, maybe in someone that doesn't even have any symptoms. So the question that I want to know and what you think about is, to what degree is collateral flow collateral blood flow formation play a role, and to what degree are we potentially opening people up to over-servicing if we're doing these interventions?
No, and I've definitely seen it both ways, where, you know, the calcium score test is kind of an opening to doing more stress testing and invasive testing. But, you know, you're wanting to literally just risk stratify the person. Now, if they're, you know, on the calcium score test, and a normal score of zero, but approximately 8% of those people with a calcium score of zero, they can still have significant plaque in their arteries. It's mostly soft plaque that hasn't yet calcified. So symptoms will always trump what you find on this imaging. So that being said, on a calcium score test, if your score is over 400, that's considered high risk. Over 1,000 is very high risk. You know, high probability one of your three coronary arteries is going to have a moderate to severe amount of stenosis. But highest scores I've ever seen one that was over 7,000 the other year. Person reported to be asymptomatic, you know, and we did a stress test. They had a kind of indeterminate stress test. So we ended up sending him for an invasive cath. And, you know, he had some moderate to severe disease, and he ended up getting a coronary intervention. And he does report his exercise tolerance is a little bit better with it. So maybe he was a little bit, you know, minimizing some of the symptoms. And so exercise tolerance improved. Okay, maybe that's a win for that gentleman. But using the calcium score test and people who have no symptoms and it's high, that is somewhat of a gray zone. You know, in my practice, when I'm still, you know, doing invasive testing, you know, if the calcium score is over 400, it's reasonable to do a stress test to see, can you provoke ischemia at peak activity? But I didn't automatically recommend cath unless people had symptoms. Now, if their score is over 1,000, there was kind of a push to kind of like, you know, automatically cath people if it's over 1,000. But, you know, you can't make somebody who feels normal better by doing something to them. And it was in my experience, you know, half the time I'd get in there, they had no appreciable luminal stenosis. You know, their arteries look like concrete pipes. You know, they had big fat arteries and the lumen's wide open, you know, and people are like, how's that possible? Like, well, it's Glascoff's principle. The artery got bigger and the plaque is like an iceberg. Most of the plaque is still in the wall of the artery. They're still very high risk of having cardiovascular events, but they're not needing a stent today. They don't need to go off to bypass surgery.
I think I want to really impress that point on the listener and really reemphasize it again, which is, just because someone has had a high calcium score doesn't necessarily mean that the lumen of their coronary arteries is stenosed and therefore the blood flow in those coronary arteries is impaired. And what you've just described, and I've heard the same thing, which is a patient goes for an invasive angiography, which again, for the listeners, is the passage of a wire through the radial artery, and then the injection of dye to visualize directly using dye and the openness or the flow in those vessels. So what she found in this particular patient was that there was a massively high calcium score, but exactly the same as what you've mentioned, Michael, which is in pristine flow. So it just shows that the process of plaque deposition was the body's response or a healing process to deal with the endothelial damage and the endothelial inflammation dysfunction that had happened because they'd been, again, breathing in diesel smoke or having high fluctuating blood glucose or running a marathon. You know, maybe they ran 300 miles in a row. but it was the body's response. So I think that point that you made is so important and critical.
Yeah, and I was actually just recently at a cardiology conference, and there was a debate, you know, between the interventionalist and the kind of kind of more, non-invasive guys. And it was really come down to where, like, the imaging is important because, irrespective of symptoms, that person's at higher risk of having events. So treat that person more aggressively with lipid-lowering therapies, blood pressure medications, if lifestyle alone doesn't get them down. Those are the people you're worried about. The people who are symptomatic, those are people pretty easy to treat. There's various antiandrogens you can use. And then if the medications don't get them to be controlled, then it's not unreasonable to offer that person a coronary intervention to help them feel better. But I always tell patients, like, stents are tools. They'll make you feel better sooner than waiting for the medications. But unless you're having a heart attack and the stent is used to stop the heart attack, the stent is not reducing risk of having a heart attack. The stent isn't extending your lifespan. It's spot welding a small area of stenosis in your artery, and you still have 60,000 other miles you have to treat.
Yeah, and the reason is because I think so often when in conventional cardiology, to the man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if your job is an interventional cardiologist and you deploy stents into people's arteries all day, I mean, you're going to find reasons to do that. And there's data that shows that that isn't a benefit in people that don't have symptoms. And yes, if you're having an ST elevation, a myocardial infarction, we rush you to the cath lab and there's a benefit, but not in a patient that that you just described. So talk to this idea of collateral flow. Why do some people, why are they able to deal with this deposition of plaque and maybe even stenosis of their arteries without developing symptoms, and why do others simply not able to cope with that?
No, it's a great question. And it's, something that even in reverse you sometimes see is that, you do an invasive angiogram in somebody, their three coronary arteries are, quote, wide open. You're like, you're good to go. You don't need a stent. But they're having classic angina. Well, they have microvascular disease, and so that's something that's been recognized for many years, at least in my practice. And at this big conference, they're starting to more and more talk about this microcirculation. But for those patients, if you're developing plaque over time, the body has an amazing ability to make new blood vessels. You make your own bypasses. So, that, hypoxic, kind of milieu causes the stem cells to get activated. You start making these bypasses. And so oftentimes, you can get in there, find that the person has a chronic total occlusion. Their artery is 100% blocked and they've had no symptoms. And you see bypasses. The arteries kind of help each other out. But the people who do worst are the people who have no collateral flow. They had this 30% blockage and then boom, it clots. Now you have 100% blockage. The other arteries haven't had a time to build collateral flow or build these natural bypasses. And those people tend to do worse at times.
Yeah, and that's exactly what, circling back to the beginning of the conversation, which is if there's some certain factors that are causing an acute damage to that endothelium and acute disabling of your endothelial healing process, and you get a massive denudation of your glycocalyx and you form a big thrombus and you just clot off, then there's obviously no time to develop collateral flow in that acute setting. The other point that seems reasonable to me is that if you're getting things like regular sunlight and you're getting especially sunlight on the chest and you're building nitric oxide directly in those vessels repeatedly, that seems to be like a good strategy for helping encourage angiogenesis or the development of collateral blood flow.
No, definitely. And there was a very fascinating trial done a few years ago. It was in Israel, the patients who were having ST elevation of MIs. I believe there's only 12 patients in the trial, so a very small kind of like proof of concept trial. But all the patients got standard of care. They got rushed to the cath lab. They all got stented, all the usual medications. But half the group got photomodulation during the cath, a day later, and 3 days later. And they didn't directly treat the heart. They treated the patient's tibia. So they were activating mesenchymal stem cells with the light therapy. And so there are protocols where you can either use your shin or you can use your manubrium, your sternum, and activate the stem cells there. And then the stem cells can help activate some of the angiogenesis.
Yeah, that's absolutely incredible. I talked to Andrew Latour of Gemba Red, who's a photobiomodulation company, and he's described the same thing, which is this so-called absorbable effect, where you can treat one part of your body and have a benefit in a completely different organ. But to me, it makes so much sense to use infrared light for acute cardiovascular care, whether that's an AMI or acute pulmonary edema or decompensated heart failure, because if we assume that there is infrared flow potentiating the blood through the cardiovascular system at the microcirculation level, then any bonus to aid in cardiovascular flow is going to be helpful. So things like a photobiomodulation device. I mean, you get zero infrared light in the cubicle of the ER room.
Correct. And this is probably the whole reason why, sauna therapy actually has such, compelling data in it, it's a lot of it's been done in Japan in like heart failure patients, and they're doing, at least four sessions a week, in the quantum world, that's obviously helping structure the water. And so, you get that, going, you get the flow going, improving, you get also the added benefit of, detoxifying from heavy metals, sure, but it's probably more that structuring of the water is probably the main benefit you're getting.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So say we've got all these people, and say we're classifying people at different cardiovascular risk all along the spectrum, and that is from the person with absolutely no disease, young guy, wants to just optimize his heart health and endothelial health, all the way to the gentleman who's had coronary artery bypass grafting and is now getting, stable angina. So that's a massive spectrum of patients and people, from the most diseased to the, the healthiest. But I think the key point is that the behaviors and the lifestyle that we're going to recommend is to everyone is actually going to be the same.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very similar. I mean, I often talk about being four lovers. There's nutrition, there's exercise. Yes, they're important. But the other two that people sometimes don't always dial in is, the stress that people are going to be exposed to. I tell people, you're always going to be exposed to stress. But how do you manage or mitigate the stress? How do you recover? And then the fourth pillar, which is actually probably the base of it, right, is sleep. I know that I did not sleep well during my medical training, every third night sleeping in the hospital, working under artificial lights, not knowing any of the stuff that I know now, abusing yourself like crazy in your 20s. But once I figured out this stuff, I stepped out of the hospital, stopped doing the damage, and didn't take any major hits by doing that. But it's telling people that you have to figure out how to sleep as best as you can, because if you don't sleep well, you will not age well. And it starts with your light environments and the timing that your food comes in.
Yeah, I know that. And that's something that I've talked about at length, and everyone who's followed the podcast is really going to be kind of up to speed with those type of interventions. Maybe we can start now by contrasting this decentralized holistic approach that you and I are advocates of, compared to this conventional approach, because to me there's radically different strategies for these primary and secondary prevention of heart disease if you're a mainstream trained cardiologist or family medicine doctor compared to someone like you or I.
Yeah, and this is where I sometimes give a lot of props to my conventional colleagues. It's a hard road to get to where they're at. It's 10 years of training to be a cardiologist. It's really hard to take all that knowledge and run out to practice and then say, I'm going to abandon all this and I'm going to try to do it a different way. It's going to be a kind of a gradual process. I often joke that it's like the Matrix. You eventually step out of the Matrix and you don't necessarily want to go back in, but you know that how you would need to if you went back in. So there's always going to be a place for conventional cardiologists, until the world wakes up and does all these lifestyle things that we're talking about. People keep having cardiac events that need hospitals. Hopefully it decreases in our lifespan, but I'm not holding my breath for that just yet. But the way to think about it is that you just want somebody who is curious, because if they're not curious, they're not going to progress in their learning. A lot of stuff I learned in my training, I no longer recommend or do, or I've heavily modified it. I don't abandon it all. Use the tool that works. Wise Healer uses the most effective tool with the least amount of side effects. Sometimes that is conventional medications. And I talked about at the beginning of the podcast, sometimes you need to be able to reverse engineer. If you don't do these things, you're going to end up with cardiogenic shock in the ICU. These are the things that can mitigate that risk. But the quantum world, it's fascinating, but one beef I have with the quantum world is that sunlight and grounding is not going to fix everything. It's a good start for many, many things, but sometimes you have to use more aggressive therapies.
Yeah, and people aren't the various degrees of bought in to lifestyle. And I like to say, and a mentor of mine, you know, he taught me, he said, it only works if the patient does it, and it only works if you do it. So, and you can recommend these gold standard lifestyle interventions to people, but if they don't do it, then they're going to be at high risk, and you need to bring other options onto the table. So, I mean, I'm completely on board with what you said, Michael, and I agree completely. And I see myself as same as you, I'm guessing, is that I'm just here to provide options for my patients. And it's up to everyone what they want to take. And as long as they have informed, explained consent about the risks and benefits of every option, whether that's medication or lifestyle, then that's my job done.
Oh, very much so, man. My whole job now is just as an educator. You know, patients come in, you know, I basically, you know, interpret any of their prior testing for them through a different lens, talk about, you know, what their arteries are doing right now and the advanced blood work, and then have a conversation. Okay, like, this is your risk right now. These are your options. What, you know, risk do you feel comfortable taking at this point?
Yeah, it's such a holistic process that we have to go through. And as we mentioned, it starts at when we're very young, and there's all these insults in our environment that are contributing to potentially, you know, building up plaque and damaging our blood vessels. So it's an ongoing battle for everyone, and it's understandable that some people go through a rougher time where they can't prioritize their health, or they have a stressful period. And we didn't mention the mechanism, but Dr. Malcolm Kendrick talks about it a lot in his book The Clot Thickens, which is high cortisol level is actually going to impair the function of the vascular endothelial progenitor cells. So your ability to repair glycocalyx damage or endothelial damage is stopped or slowed or delayed or retarded when you're acutely stressed, whether that's someone dying, a family member passes away, or you're about to get fired for your job, or, you know, someone breaks up with you, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a process.
No, and that's just a quick side note. You know, that's a stress-induced cardiomyopathy. You know, that's Takotsubo syndrome. I definitely saw many cases of that in my career. You know, patient shows up, you know, after a stressful event. You know, the EKG looks like a heart attack. They're having all the same symptoms of the heart attack: chest pain, radiating up to the neck or back. Rush them to the cath lab. Their coronary arteries are wide open. You do a left ventriculogram. You know, the base of the heart barely moves. The apex is pounding away. It's a stress-induced cardiomyopathy because that extremely high cortisol and adrenaline, you know, vasoconstricts all the microcirculation. And then once the acute stressor is kind of mitigated, you know, often use some beta blockers to kind of help knock down some of the adrenaline, that left ventricular function improves back to normal. So if it can happen acutely, it definitely happens chronically for patients as well.
Yeah, and the, what is going to drive up these cortisol level, you know, maybe subclinically over a long period of time, and that is blue light. And being exposed to artificial light at night and dysregulating your cortisol melatonin curve that is inherent or is critical in your circadian rhythm. So that's another mechanism that the light stress could contribute to the development of heart disease. But let's talk about, because we're on the topic of conventional treatments, let's talk about a conventional doctor wants to reduce someone's risk of heart disease. And look, let's say that they've addressed these common traditional risk factors. And by that, I mean blood pressure, diabetes, or insulin resistance. Obviously, we can't do too much about family history. You know, smoking. They've all addressed those. So what we've got to this last one, which is this lipid level and cholesterol level. So what is their approach, and how do you agree or disagree with them?
So say in the conventional world, you know, they're going to be thinking about antiplatelet therapy, so aspirin, 81 milligrams for the majority, blood pressure control, you know, ideally less than 120 over 80, and they will often use, you know, combination of diuretics, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, ACE inhibitors, or angiotensin receptor blockers. Of those, honestly prefer that they would use the ACE ARBs or the calcium channel blockers, because those actually lower central aortic blood pressure. The diuretics and the beta blockers make your blood pressure look pretty when they check your arm, but if you actually put a catheter back up in their heart, their pressures are not necessarily controlled with those medicines. So I try to limit those medicines to like third or fourth line. And then they're going to use generally a high dose statin. Like it's going to be Lipitor 40, 80. It's going to be Crestor 20 or 40. And those are the options. You know, I tend to use a lot more low dose statin therapy if I'm going to use it. And we use the advanced testing to kind of, you know, kind of guide to say like, okay, well, is this person likely a hyperproducer of sterols, or if they're a hyperabsorber of sterols, well, maybe ezetimibe's a better option for this person. So it's mostly, you know, statin, aspirin, and some type of blood pressure agent is kind of the standard of care, but those are good starting points, but they don't really improve nitric oxide availability in the majority.
Yeah. And a quick mention about those blood pressure lowering medications. I've just released a course called the Solar Callus course, and I'm talking about medications that can increase our photosensitivity or likelihood of sunburning. And this is important because if we're getting out into full spectrum sunlight that includes ultraviolet light, then we don't want to be taking anything that's going to make us sunburn. And it happens that hydrochlorothiazide, thiazide diuretics, furosemide, as well as medications like statins, atorvastatin, and amiodarone are all responsible for increasing our photosensitivity. So it's a little bit of a catch-22 when we've got a situation where we're trying to lower someone's blood pressure by giving them a thiazide diuretic when that's perhaps precluding them from getting full-spectrum sunlight, when the actual solution to their problem is UVA light to promote the nitric oxide to essentially do it a nature's way, to reduce their blood pressure Mother Nature's way.
Right. Yeah. It's, yeah. Yeah. The pharmaceutical ways of doing things, they work, but, you know, do you have to pull them out all the time? No. I mean, you know, somebody runs into your office and their blood pressure is 200 over 110. Well, you got to throw the kitchen sink at them while you're trying to figure out, like, why are they so dysregulated? But, you know, one of my favorite things to do is de-prescribe medications. You know, patients come in with a whole host of meds. You start working on these lifestyle things, and you start trying to peel all these medications back whenever you can.
So I agree with that. That's a good, that's very satisfying. But let's talk about this primary prevention in someone who hasn't had a heart attack, and all they've got essentially wrong is a high ApoB or LDL cholesterol. And they don't have atherogenic dyslipidemia, which is a medical speak for the high-risk lipid panel, which also includes a low HDL and a high triglyceride. So let's just say that they have a high LDL ApoB, which is typical or possible on a low carb or carnivore diet, not in everyone, but in some, and their conventional doctor prescribes them atorvastatin. What's your opinion on that?
I mean, I've seen a lot of those cases where patients have had, you know, relatively normal lipid panels. They go carnivore, keto, and they have these, you know, severe, you know, dysregulated lipid panels. And yes, it generally it is that, you know, they do not have high triglycerides or low HDL in the panel. But that doesn't mean that those particles are not necessarily atherogenic. I tell patients, like, you got to show me that you have healthy nitric oxide levels, you don't have vascular inflammation, and a calcium score test is a good point, but if you want bonus, do a CT angio and show me that you don't have a lot of salt plaque building up. Not everybody who eats those diets has that type of lipid response. You know, it's really maybe about 20% of the population has a pretty significant response to higher saturated fat in their diet. Sometimes in these patients, if they, you know, cut their saturated fat to less than 8% of their total calories, you know, eat more fish, more olive oil, they may not have significant bumps in their ApoB particles. But in my practice, I typically will use the Boston Heart Lab panel to look at not only their ApoE status, because it's the ApoE4s that tend to have this happen more often, but the people who are hyperabsorbers of sterols, especially the beta side of sterol, they tend to have this pattern more often. And the statins might work, but if the person is not willing to change their diet, then ezetimibe would work better, prevent the sterols from being reabsorbed from the gut, and you generally get a significant reduction in their lipoprotein burden then.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you made, and I think it's relevant because people sometimes go on a carnivore type diet and they have a, you know, this high ApoB or LDL, and they're almost, you know, kind of say, okay, I'm at low risk because I'm eating carnivore. And my perspective is that you're addressing perhaps one of the contributors to endothelial damage and poor vascular health, and that is insulin resistance and perhaps fluctuating blood glucose. But if you're getting blue light, if you're blue light toxic, if you're not grounding, if you're doing other things that are disrupting your structured water, And you have endothelial dysfunction, which is what we've just talked about, and then there's no protection against that sudden, a clotting event that can occur, and therefore your risk of AMI is not zero.
Right. And I think it's a nuanced approach to every patient. Is that, you know, can carnivore make people's gut health better and they just, you know, their joints are better? Of course it is. But, you know, you still have to look at, like, what are the arteries doing with this lipoprotein burden? You know, you're mimicking familial hyperlipidemia. Now, there are people with FH who don't go on to have CBR disease. And if you have a calcium score of zero and you've had FH, good for you. That means whatever you're doing means you have a healthy glycocalyx. But not everybody who's carnivore is necessarily going to be that same pattern.
Yeah, so it really seems like we have to focus on the endothelial health first. And as you said, I really like your framing, is that the patient has to prove to you that their blood vessels are healthy in order to be able to tolerate or be able to deal with that perhaps higher lipoprotein burden and that not necessarily contribute to the deposition of plaque. I'm really thinking about it a lot lately because there's almost two armed camps that are polarizingly assembling, you know, with weapons raised on either side. And on one side is, you know, the strict carnivore, you know, any type of raised ApoB isn't an issue at all. And if obviously the triglycerides are low and the HDL is reasonable. But then the opposite side of the picture is guys like Dr. Muhammad Allo, who has made, I mean, some of his calls they've been outlandish and just patently false. But he's really advocating for statin therapy for basically anyone who has an ApoB above this arbitrary threshold, which is, I'm just wondering, do you have any more thoughts on those two kind of polarizing opinions and how to split the middle the most effectively?
You're very much right. You know, it is polarizing. It's that, you know, the patient's just trying to find out, like, what do they need to do for themselves? And, you know, like statins, you know, they're tools. They should not be in the water where we're all taking them, and they're not horrible for everybody. You know, I often get the concerns, you know, like, oh, it's a mitochondrial toxin. It's going to give me diabetes. Like, it doesn't take somebody who's not insulin resistant and make them frank diabetic. You know, is a mitochondrial toxin? A little bit, but it's probably taking out the weak mitochondria so that you replace them with better. And it's it's risk versus reward. You know, nothing is risk-free for the most part. You know, but in the right selected population, you know, statins can be the right tool for that person. But the other side of the equation, you know, having an ApoB of 20, that is not evolutionarily feasible for everybody. You know, are there people that have low ApoBs? Yeah. My own father has an ApoB of 43 with no meds, but he has a loss of function PCSK9 gene. His grandmother had that. She lived 106. So, okay, but not everybody has that pattern. You know, do we need to use three pharmaceutical agents to drive everybody down there? I don't think so. You know, it's never been studied or shown that that's really where we need to be targeting people for. So I just really think that, you know, we've had a great conversation. I was like, you know, what is the glycocalyx doing? Like, how much can you support the structured water in the body? You know, I often talk about being like, it's a force field. If your force field's up, it's less likely that these lipoproteins are kind of crashing the gates and getting through. It's possible, but just not as likely.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. I mean, I've delved into the statin as mitochondrial toxin issue as well. And there's a particular paper that I have in mind. I think it was published in 2017. And it details, there's a number of mechanisms biochemically, and obviously what is happening at the bench level or what we find in the lab is not always translatable in vivo, but there was mechanisms involving reduction of mitochondrial membrane potential. There was acceleration of apoptosis, there's a range of mechanisms. So to me, it doesn't seem like a drug that we should be throwing around willy-nilly. And the rhetoric that you hear out of so many conventional mainstream centralized cardiologists is that this is a drug without side effects. And that is the impression that you get when you hear some of their rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have side effects. And, you know, we talked about some of them earlier. I mean, the musculoskeletal ones are real. And in the trials, you know, it's a few percentage points. But in the real world, you know, it's quarter of the patients might have some symptoms. You really queried them hard enough. But I do a pretty, you know, comprehensive screening in somebody before I'm going to recommend these things. You know, I want to know what their ApoE genotype is. If they're an ApoE4, I'm probably not going to push it very hard on them. You know, what is their vitamin D status? If you're vitamin D deficient, you pretty much always get myalgias on statins. You know, if your CoQ10 is low at baseline, well, you're just going to make it worse adding the statin on board. If you're hypothyroid, much more likely to have muscle symptoms. And then in some instances that people have already tried them and had a lot of issues, you know, then I'll do some genetics, and there's a gene called SLCL1B1. If you have an abnormal copy of that, you know, you're 2, 3, 4 times more likely to have muscle symptoms with statins. So no, they're not risk-free, but, you know, there's patients that you can select that, you know, generally are going to tolerate them well. And if, you know, they can't tolerate them, or they just only say like, hey doc, I just don't want to take this. Okay. There's, you know, bempedoic acid, there's Reddy's rice, there's bergamot, there's berberine, there's PCSK9 inhibitors, ezetimibe. There's a whole host of other options if you're really going to go down the route of trying to help somebody lower their lipoproteins.
Yeah, and I think the one mechanism we haven't mentioned in terms of lipid lowering is the sun. And there are multiple randomized controlled trials showing that sunlight, UV light, lowers lipid profiles, lowers LDL, lowers ApoB, and lowers, I believe, triglycerides too. You might be, you know, you might ask, okay, well, what is the effect size? And maybe the effect size isn't as dramatic as, you know, rapidly changing the diet to a, you know, low carb, or, you know, rapidly doing those. But there is observational and interventional evidence that sunlight reduces ApoB. Can you talk to this precaution of these E4 carriers and why you might not prescribe them a statin?
So when you have an ApoE4 allele, it's going to affect your LDL receptors. Your LDL receptors are going to be, you know, not as plentiful, and they're probably not going to be as functioning. So your LDL receptors sit on the outside of the liver, and they grab these ApoE particles as they go by and pull them into the liver. But the ApoE4 carriers, they're at increased risk of diabetes. They're at increased risk of Alzheimer's, which is likely a form of insulin resistance in the brain, coupled with subclinical, or I should say more microvascular disease. So the same things that are causing plaque in the coronary arteries are the same thing that do it in the brain. And then when you hit enough neurons, then they're going to call you Alzheimer's. But the ApoE4 carriers, they just tend to have more side effects with the high dose statin. So often I'll just use low dose, or sometimes even intermittent dose to rosuvastatin in those people.
Yeah. And there's so many other areas, I believe. Dr. Malcolm Kendrick wrote a really good article in 2018 that's worth reading, that was looking at the odds ratio of the development of Lou Gehrig's disease. So, which is essentially you lose your motor neurons over voluntary muscle contractions. And the odds ratio for statin use is enormous. And again, it's a rare disease, but, you know, if you go on from, you know, 8 cases per 100,000 to 40 cases per 100,000, that's a significant relative increase, and those are pretty compellingly linked to statin usage. So I don't know if you've encountered that or have an opinion on that.
I haven't seen that particular study, but, you know, again, it's, you know, nothing's risk-free, and so it's like, you know, if you've had, you know, your grandmother die at, you know, 59 and you're 40 and, you know, statin's been recommended, maybe the, you know, your risk of atherosclerosis taking you out is higher than a neurological. But if you're, you know, a 25-year-old woman with, quote, high cholesterol, yeah, statins are probably not the right tool for that person.
Yeah, look, that it's such a good advice, and it's really hammering home the point that this needs to be an individual decision. And so many, unfortunately, the way that there's not a lot of access for people to get a nuanced opinion like by a practitioner like yourself, Michael, so that people seem to be doing a lot of self-decision, self-diagnosing, and self-treating based on what they listen on the internet. And really, they need someone to take into account all their risk factors, their endothelial health, and everything that we've talked about to make an individualized opinion. It's hard when this decentralized movement is growing and there's so much contrasting and conflicting information for people to, you know, make the right decision.
No, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here and chat with you and your audience. I mean, I think people probably should go back and listen to this one, you know, once or twice, and, you know, they'll hear a lot of the same themes. You know, we're talking about nitric oxide, endothelial function, the glycocalyx, vascular inflammation, you know, it's all, you know, connected. You know, I tell patients, you know, sometimes these words are complicated, but when you actually sit down and think about like what you need to do on a day-to-day basis to have healthy arteries, it's really not that hard. It's really just, so can you keep nitric oxide levels high? Can you keep inflammation low? And if you need to modulate lipoproteins, figure out which best lifestyle, supplement, medication you're going to be able to use to modulate the lipoproteins then.
Yeah, great advice. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for coming on. Do you have any parting thoughts that you want to share with the listeners, or any topics or questions that I didn't ask you?
No, I just often tell patients, you know, that, you know, you do have to be your own doctor, and your doctor, you know, is supposed to be your guide. You know, your health is in your own hands, and, you know, your lifestyle determines about 80% to 90% of what's going to happen with you. So in your mind, just try to set up, you know, what an optimal day is for you, and try to win that day every day. You know, it should start with seeing morning light. It should be including some amount of grounding outside, you know, ideally do some stress management, and then highly prioritize your sleep. You know, you should be sleeping, you know, 7.5, 8 hours every night and feeling very well rested. If you're not sleeping well, start there.
Yeah, fantastic advice. Michael Twyman, thank you so much for coming on the Regenerative Health Podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And where can people find you, follow you, even employ your services if they're interested?
So my practice, Apollo Cardiology, is in St. Louis, Missouri. We are still accepting patients. You know, our patients always come to us initially for their first visit. You know, we do a comprehensive head-to-toe cardiovascular assessment. You know, I call them toys. We have all the toys in the office to test your endothelial function, your vascular health, and then all follow-up visits can be done remotely. I'm relatively active on social media, on Instagram. I have a IG Live every Monday night, 6 p.m. Central Time. Yeah, right now, kind of doing more just an ask me anything type of format. So patients can, or now potential patients or just people who are interested in following me, you know, they submit questions ahead of time. And it's, some of the questions are similar to tonight about, you know, lipoproteins or, you know, grounding or sauna or, you know, something that along those lines that benefit other people. And then my website, drtwyman.com, you know, some links to my other podcast, and, you know, people are interested in following out where else I online, that it'll be on drtwyman.com.
Great. Fantastic. I'll include all that information so the listeners can have ready.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I hope this episode helped you better understand some aspect of improving your lifestyle for optimal health. If you enjoyed this episode, then share it out with friends and family. Leaving a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify podcasts also helps spread the message. Thank you, and see you next time.